Shockwaves are usually pretty bad. I mean, if you want to be cool, then shockwaves are great. But shockwaves are usually very detrimental to an aircraft's performance, which is bad. So can we get rid of them? Can we travel faster than sound and not have shockwaves? As you probably know, shockwaves form when you approach the sound barrier because the air in front of the object gets so squished that it actually forms a barrier of high pressure, and that's the shock. With that shock, we get a whole host of unpleasant effects, from increased drag to boundary layer separation to even stall sometimes. So back in the 1950s, for example, when Ian Shepherd and friends were trying to break the sound barrier, they pioneered the idea of making the aircraft very pointy. That allowed it to pierce the shock and move through with far less drag and negative effects. In fact, this way was so effective that this is the most common way that we use to break the sound barrier today. But that technology is almost 100 years old now. Is there any other way that we can deal with shocks? Well, since then, our technology has progressed in more ways than you can keep track of, and that brings up a new way of controlling shockwaves. That's with plasma. So a couple of months ago, in podcast 173, we went through some research that showed that it was very possible to control shockwaves that formed over an object. The research was not 100% successful at mitigating the shock, but it showed that the plasma generator could affect it. So today in this podcast, we are going to go further and look at some more research on mitigating shockwaves with plasma. So we're looking at research that considered the flow at Mach 2.5, which is really fast. To give you an idea of just how fast that is, only the fastest fighter jets today can really reach that speed, and most others are too slow to even get there. And another comparison is that when you fly, you're only going about Mach 0.85, which is just one third of Mach 2.5. So this velocity is really fast. In fact, if you were to go any faster, you'd start to risk hitting hypersonic speeds. And that brings on a whole new host of flow physics and potential problems. So if you watch our YouTube channel, you might have seen a video called "What is a Shockwave Aerofundamentals Number 47? In that video, we explained how the angle of the shockwave depended very much on the speed. So at Mach 2.5, the angle of the shockwave around the object will be quite angled. And to look at how plasma can be used to control the shockwave and even its angle, we're looking at an open access paper called, if I scroll up here, Air Plasma Mitigation of Shockwave. So you can find this in the link below. So one really cool thing about this research is that it is an experiment. So I know having a wind tunnel that can reach Mach 2.5 is rare and really cool. So we're going to see some cool data today from a supersonic wind tunnel. Let's look at the setup. In figure 1A, we see the wind tunnel, and whenever you see a wind tunnel with a lot of heavy duty bolts, like around here, you can see all these heavy duty bolts, and it just looks like very thick steel to begin with. That is a very good indication that the flow is supersonic and even hypersonic inside. So the reason why these wind tunnels are built so much more sturdily than regular wind tunnels is that because the flow is so fast and the way that they generate such fast speeds, the pressure inside of them are far greater than a regular wind tunnel. Now this tunnel only has a working cross-section of 0.38 meters by 0.38 meters, and that is very common for supersonic wind tunnels to have such a small cross-sectional area for the working section. So one major reason why that is because it is really hard to get the flow moving at supersonic speeds. So you need a large contraction ratio and usually a very large tank upstream with very high pressure air. So you can only really afford a small test section that you then release the air into, and that reduction from very high pressure to low pressure results in that very fast velocity. And in figure 1C, we see the plasma generator being activated and the plasma being created at the tip. One other really cool thing about this tunnel is that the temperature of the air inside when it's going through the test section is only 135 degrees Kelvin, or 135 Kelvin, there's no degrees, but 135 Kelvin. So like minus 170 degrees Celsius. Just thinking about that makes me cold. So let's move on. So the object they are testing is literally just a cone, as we see in figure 1B, with a rounded nose to it. At the front of the nose, the plasma generator is located, so just here, and the cone has an angle of 30 degrees from the center line. So the plasma generator is operated at 60 hertz, which is a very common frequency. I wonder if it actually has to do with the general frequency or the mains power, which would then reduce the need for like intermediate capacitors and stuff, or whether that's just coincidence here. So the voltage is 4,500 volts, and the electric field intensity is over 50,000 volts per meter. Now they say that the peak electron density is estimated to exceed 10 to the power of 19 electrons per cubic meter. So I have no idea if that is a lot or not. It's so high, I can't really comprehend it. But that is 10 quintillion electrons per cubic meter coming out of this plasma generator. So apparently, even at higher altitudes on Earth, we still only get about 1 quadrillion electrons per cubic meter. So I guess 10 quintillion is a lot, about 10,000 times more. So hopefully the researchers had a lot of antioxidant-rich food that day. So to visualize the shocks and the flow in general, we are shown in figure 3, for example. If we scroll down, the researchers used shadowography. And that is very similar to Schlieren, but simpler because you generally just rely on different densities of the fluid to refract the oncoming light, and that creates shadows in the regions where the light has been refracted away and no other light has entered its place. So you can see here in these figures, these like darker regions, these lines, those are the shocks. But actually, when you look at figure 2, so they say that they use shadowography, but here in figure 2, it looks a little bit more like Schlieren because the light source is shown onto a parabolic mirror, which then in effect makes the light more collimated. So it's like all going in the same direction. And that is the underlying principle of old school Schlieren. So either way, it doesn't really matter too much. All that really matters here is that they use different densities in the air to refract the light different amounts, and then that creates the shadows on the image that correspond to where the shadows occur, to where the shocks occur. So one really cool thing that these researchers did was put filters on the camera lens to reduce the amount of light hitting the camera from the plasma discharge. That is a smart thing to do because that plasma discharge, that is light, as we can see in figure 1, there's this like blue whitish light coming off there that's going to corrupt the results. So putting filters onto the camera is a great idea. And that is pretty much it for the experimental setup, because the data is only coming from images. It is very easy to set up, and that is the beauty of FlowVis techniques. They never get credited with the credit they deserve, but a well thought out FlowVis campaign is worth as much as any quantitative method and at a fraction of the cost and time. With this setup, this researcher could literally get all the data by lunchtime and then go home early. So what's more, because FlowVis is often qualitative, the acceptable error is usually higher, which means that the method is usually more robust. Only when you're looking at phenomena that changes with slight changes of condition do you need to really pin down errors. So that is what is so great about FlowVis. And if you're listening to this, next time you're running experiments, consider doing some FlowVis of some sort, because you'll be surprised at just how powerful it is, how quick it is, and how much data you'll get for almost no effort really compared to quantitative methods. So let's move on to the results. So now in figure 3, this figure here, we see in the left column the shock wave over the object without any plasma being discharged. This is again at a flow of Mach 2.5. There is a clear shock that is forming right on the cone and bends slightly around the object. So we can see it forms right here, and then it's not exactly linear coming off, but it bends a little bit. In the right column, we see the effects of the plasma generator on the shock and at the exact same conditions of Mach 2.5 and the exact same object and everything. So now the shockwave is far less noticeable though with the plasma. It is very clear that the shock doesn't really progress past the object, and what bit of the shock there is seems to be broken up because zooming in, let me zoom in here, we can see the shock is not really clear, like it's just coming off a little bit compared to without the plasma generator. There's a very clear shock here. And in the last figure on the right, the shock is almost non-existent. Now, the interesting thing is that if we scroll to figure 4, we see the plasma discharge cycle and the effects of the cycle on the shockwave. What this figure shows is that depending on where you are in the discharge cycle, the shockwave may be more prominent or less prominent. So you can see here it changes in terms of how obviously it is in the images. That makes sense because plasma is not being generated constantly throughout the cycle. Or at least to some extent, there are some points where the plasma is definitely less than other points. As such, at some points in the cycle, the more plasma that exists or less plasma exists will change the shockwave and mitigate it more or less. So if you get if you constantly get rid of the shockwave, if you want to do that, then maybe more than one plasma generator would be required, because when one generator is in the part of the cycle where plasma isn't being produced, and hence the shockwave would be stronger, the other generator is in the part of the cycle where it does produce plasma and then can take over that shockwave mitigation, so they can work together to reduce the shock overall. So another thing that is really interesting is the progression of the shockwave attenuation in the cycle. So figure four, we see that as the plasma generator progresses through the cycle, the shock becomes weakened more and more. It doesn't just instantaneously break down, like for example in figure 4a here. It is very prominent. As we go all the way down to figure 4d, you can see it gets weaker and weaker before it's almost non-existent. That means that with this approach, you can not only mitigate the shock, but actually control how strong it is really, which is much more beneficial when you think about it, because you can now mitigate it if you want, but if there is some other purpose you have for the shock, I'm not sure what you'd want to do with it, but if there is a reason, at least you can toggle how much you want. So something else to note is that the shockwave does not form off the nose of the cone. It is still attached to the cone, and that is in contrast with some other research where plasma generators can make the shockwave stand off the object. So it's actually not forming on the object, it's like a few centimeters ahead of it. So I think perhaps here, the shockwave isn't pushing ahead of the object, the shockwave, because there's probably isn't that much plasma. Or it could be that the direction of the plasma is being discharged not directly upstream, so more to an angle. That could also result in the shockwave not being pushed much upstream. So if the plasma was discharged so that it traveled upstream slightly, then that would create a force on the oncoming flow, and I think that would probably cause a shockwave to stand off the object more, at least. And interestingly, from the podcast we did a couple of months ago, we also saw that the plasma generator there affected the shockwave. It didn't mitigate it, but it had an effect on it. Now, in this paper, some of the effects were good and some of the effects were bad. But for this paper here that we're looking at, the effects seem largely good. So that goes to show you how different plasma generators can affect the shockwave. And not only also the setups of the different plasma generators, but also the strength of the electrical charge going through it. Because in that other podcast, we saw how changing the electrical strength going through the circuit, through the plasma generator, had a significant effect on the shockwave. And from memory, generally, more electrical power resulted in a greater effect on the shockwave, which makes sense. So the next question is, how does the plasma actually affect the shock in this paper? Well, in figure 5, we see some information about it. So down here in figure 5, we see in figure 5b, this one here, the object with a little plasma being discharged, so this little bit of blue here, and then 5c, we see plasma being discharged a lot, so a lot more blue. And we see a corresponding furthering weakening of the shock. So in figure 5b, the shock is still pretty strong. In figure 5c, it's almost gone. Also, you can also see some shocks coming from, I think this would probably be the tube measuring the velocity of the flow up here. So the authors say that the shock wave is effectively weakened because the plasma and the associated electrical field around the electrode deflects the incoming flow more. That then is exactly what is needed to prevent a shock from forming. So in other plasma research, as I mentioned, the plasma is often used to actually push the shock wave and alter it like that. It's an actual force that pushes upstream. In this particular setup, the plasma isn't directly pushing the air away, like back where it's coming from, but rather it's redirecting the air around the object more, and that counteracts the formation of the shock. It's actually ingenious how simple it is. So a shockwave forms because when you have air hitting an object at very high speeds, the air can't move around the object fast enough. As such, just as one group of air is hitting the object and trying to move around it, another group of air comes from behind and rams straight into it. Then that first group of air is now in the way and holding up the second group. And then just as that is happening, a third group now comes in and rams into the second group, which is still hitting the first group. And all of a sudden, you now have all this air being squashed together, all because the air cannot move around the object fast enough. So by using the plasma here to help push the air out of the way faster, you reduce how much air is ramming into the object, and hence how much the air is being squashed together, and hence reduce the shockwave strength. So it's a really clever idea in how simple it is. It really gets to the root of why shockwaves form and really mitigates it from that point of view, which is really a good idea. So from this figure, it is logical to think that if you just increase the power through the plasma generator, then the plasma will come out faster and further reduce the shockwave strength. So now in figure 6, we see that, in figure 6B at least, as the intensity of the plasma discharge increases, the local Mach number reduces, which is what we were kind of alluding to before, where if you increase the power of the circuit, you increase the amount of plasma or the strength of that plasma coming out, and then that changes the flow field even more and can mitigate shocks even more. In figure 6A, we see some superimposed images of different shock waves, which also highlight this a little bit more as well with the different electrical discharges. So it's a little confusing, this image, but essentially the gist is that the discharge intensity, as it increases, the shockwave moves further away from the object and eventually becomes a detached shock, which is now what we have seen in other research as well. So with that, we come to the end of this podcast. We revisited the idea of controlling a shockwave with plasma, but this is different. But this time we saw that the plasma could actually mitigate the shockwave in theory completely if we just keep making the plasma stronger. And there is also a relationship between the speed of the flow, the plasma discharge intensity, and how much the shockwave was mitigated. In effect, the greater the flow velocity, the stronger you need to make the plasma coming out of the electrode. And then there will come a point where you can actually reduce the strength of the shockwave. And while this research didn't show complete mitigation of the shockwave, I guess it could be possible from theory. And with that, we might need to leave that for another topic to see if we can actually mitigate shockwaves completely with plasma, as opposed to with this one we saw, like 90% mitigation kind of thing. So if you like this episode, hit the like button. And if you want to see more like this, hit the subscribe or follow button, whichever platform you're on. And finally, if you want to do complex CFD like sliding meshes, dynamically morphing meshes, and even overset meshes, but don't really know how to do them, then we have big news for you. So we just released the other day our course to show you how to do all this in OpenFOAM, which is a completely free and good CFD software. And I personally am really proud of this course because it is far more comprehensive than anything I have found online. And like, for example, the overset mesh module. Online, there are some tutorials on overset meshes, and okay, if you know how to do OpenFOAM well, then you might be able to use these tutorials to learn, but probably not. I mean, there are a lot of steps missing. And even in the OpenFOAM tutorials folder, there isn't a good overset tutorial either. There are, again, a lot of steps missing. They have to really infer yourself, and it leads to a lot of errors, and you don't know how to do it. So in our course, we literally take you step by step and even give you fully worked master files that you can use as a template and just sub in your geometry for whatever you need to do. We actually do that for every module as well, from simple rotating walls and MRFs, which by the way are actually harder to set up than you might think, and then all the way to sliding meshes, dynamically morphing meshes, and overset meshes. And because this is an advanced course, you need to make sure that your mesh is good quality. Otherwise, your simulations won't be accurate. So we actually go through how to make a good mesh as well. So it's a holistic approach, and even how to find the regions where the bad mesh is and how to fix them. And that's not even the end of the course. We also included how to make your simulations run way faster and be much more stable. So instead of like a simulation taking like a month, it might only take a few days. So as I said, I'm really proud of this course and maybe the proudest out of all the courses we've made so far. So if you want to learn how to do really high level CFD, take that course in the link below. And also, if you don't know any OpenFOAM, like you're listening to this and thinking, okay, I'd love to know how to do this, but I don't even know how to do OpenFOAM at all. Well, we also have a course that teaches you step by step how to do OpenFOAM. It literally takes you from just even installing the software all the way to running your own DS simulations and everything between. So you can find that in the link below as well. And with that, we are at the end of this podcast, and I'll see you next one. Peace, amigos.